Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora koutou katoa. Thanks for joining me, Marianne Stone, and the GOAT New Zealand book podcaster Maureen Rout for another week of Bookends. This week, I interview authors whose books deal with the supernatural. Mandy Hager's thriller, Revenge and Rabbit Holes, the second in her Chasing Goats trilogy. And I'm a bit starstruck getting to chat to Mandy, so forgive me if I stutter. Then we hear edited clips from Maureen's live interview with award-winning journalist and podcaster Lana Hart, discussing her debut novel, Nice People on Planes. That's as in aeroplanes, i.e. this is not a novel about all the fabulous people on Planes Media, but it is a nice chance to give them a shout out. We love Planes Media and all community broadcasting all over the country. And finally, I get to chat with Vanessa Young about her creative memoir, The Reluctant Homeopath. It's a brave and open book, and I hope everyone enjoys where that conversation takes us. So, on to the show. If you are or have recently been a parent of a young adult reader, you may well be familiar with the work of Mandy Hager. In 2019, she won the Margaret Mahe Lifetime Achievement Award for her contribution to Aotearoa literature for this audience, a highlight in a multi-award-winning career. Last year, her 2024 published novel Grasshopper was included on the prestigious White Ravens International Library for Young Readers list. Like all other great YA writers, all her titles make excellent reading for any lover of literature. But she is also a writer of fiction specifically targeting adult readers. Her historical novel, Heloise, was shortlisted for the Ockham in 2017, and her Chasing Ghosts trilogy likewise has an adult reader in mind. Although there's an accessibility in the style of this series that I find hard and a little unnecessary to classify, we'll talk more about that for sure. The second in the series, Revenge and Rabbit Holes, was published by Cuba Press in October 2024. After a couple of false starts for boring health and scheduling reasons, we finally get a chance to discuss it with Mandy this morning. Tēnā koe, Mandy. Welcome to Bookends.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
Oh, well, it's a real pleasure. Congratulations, by the way, on that 2025 White Ravens recognition. That's amazing. What's the process for putting a book forward or having a book selected for that?
I'm not entirely sure. I think it's something that the publishers do. So they just contacted me one day and said, you're on it, which was really amazing.
Yeah.
To know that it's in the National Youth Library is very cool.
Yeah, that is. Congratulations again. So for this book, Revenge and Rabbit Holes, the rabbit holes in the title is a reference to one of the novel's major thriller plot lines, okay? This isn't international spies, right? That's local, fake news-inspired, dipshit, destructive activism. That's what we're dealing with here as a thriller. But it's no less scary for all that kind of immediacy and scale. In fact, it's frightening because it feels so close to home and plausible. I imagine that's kind of the point, right?
That is the point, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although it's local, it's a problem, I think, that people are seeing all over the world. So it's a global problem, but also a local problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem, just describe that to us for the listeners.
Well, just the amount of fake news that has come out, particularly since COVID, and has just swamped all the different social media platforms and has sent people down really kind of crazy, worrying rabbit holes where their thinking gets skewed, and it's very, very hard to get people out of that. And it plays to people's fears and anxieties and often their disconnection from their community.
Yeah, and the whole radicalization aspect of that as well for, in particular in this instance, a vulnerable young man.
Yes, I was thinking about the protests at Parliament and all the people who were there. You know, many of them good, decent people who really felt strongly about stuff but were kind of hoodwinked into worrying about things that weren't real instead of looking at the things that were real. And it just really worries me how it's dislocating people, and it's disconnecting people from proper kind of discussion of issues and politics, and makes it really hard for real activists, because protest has kind of been muddied now. So how do you combat that?
Yeah. So rabbit holes. Then there's the revenge part of the title, and that refers to a second and closely woven plot line, the plot that connects directly to the book, the first book of this series. So yeah. That's almost a spoiler, but I hope it's bleak enough to be forgiven. And what I wonder is, does that storyline still have legs beyond this one for the final book? Or is it more that our heroine's personal story needs finishing, another phase of Bella's development? Or is that kind of original storyline still got another chapter in it?
Not in my head, no. And I haven't ever thought of this as a trilogy, to be honest.
Oh.
I just wrote it, started thinking, well, if it's a series that people seem to enjoy, then I'll keep going.
Right.
So I'm not even sure at the moment whether there'll be a third one, although I do have an idea kind of prodding at me. But I just felt that was such a big story that it had to have repercussions further down the track. Yeah.
Yeah. And Bella is and Freya, they are a terrific duo with real chemistry. So it would be great to see them again. Is Bella pretty much modelled on a younger man, on a 30-year-old Mandy Hagar?
It would probably be a 30-year-old Mandy now, because climate change is the biggest issue that we need to be confronting. And it's very frustrating to me that it keeps getting swept aside quite often by all these manufactured things that keep making the news, which is just kind of muddying the waters for what is actually an existential crisis that needs to be discussed and dealt with.
Yeah.
So it's definitely the thing closest to my heart.
Yeah. And I wonder too about her forthrightness and her bravery, whether those are aspects of your own character.
No, I'm happiest stuck behind my computer screen. So I'm not, which I guess Bella is a bit too. But I do think that it's probably time that we all stepped up and became vocal, because it's getting very desperate. And I've now got three little grandkids, and I just am so deeply worried for their futures that I feel like anybody that feels that way, particularly with an election coming up, should actually start to access their democratic rights and say what they're worried about and demand that there's action.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And we've just had so much evidence of the impact of climate on the country, on our country and globally, but we've been experiencing it so much through the summer around the Motu. So I'm sure that that theme echoes for a lot of people. We can't not talk about spiritual guidance and ghosts and mediums and as we talk about this book. Could you introduce the listeners to Freya, Mandy, sure, and say who she is and just her relationship to Bella?
Sure. So Freya is a 70-year-old expat from Denmark. So she came out here when she was a teenager, when her parents were wanting to leave Europe during a time of nuclear escalation. And she is a psychic empath. And so she has three lady spirit guides that feed her information, and she sees private clients. She's, as a lot of European women are, she's forthright in her views, and her goal is to help people through whatever it is that they're suffering. So she's very much about trying to soothe people and help them through their troubled times. And Bella and Freya meet when Bella's home is destroyed in a landslide and a flooding event on the west coast down south. And Freya is Bella's publisher's aunt. Freya is losing her eyesight to macular degeneration. So she's at a point in her life where, having been fiercely independent, she's now having to rely on someone. So the first book is about them kind of getting to know each other. Bella not believing in any of that stuff, but things happen that become undeniable that Freya does seem to have some kind of connection to things that are not otherwise known.
Mm. And we experience that again in this novel. Scientific integrity and the nature of truth is, as you've kind of talked, that's a critical central theme for the book. So bringing spirits and ghosts into it could have made that message a bit murky. And I wonder, was it an uncomfortable decision to invite spirits and ghosts into your writing?
Well, to me, in a way, it's about intuition, and it's the way that writers work. So we find little bits and we follow clues and we find metaphors for things and make links in a way that other people might not. And so to me, it was a way of exploring creativity. Freya is an outsider and she is not believed by a lot of people. And so there are problems with that that add tension to the book. So although she might believe she is right and is often proved to be right, how does she then be taken seriously by people who don't believe in that? And so I thought that would add tension to the book. And I've always kind of written a lot about loss and grief, I guess because I've experienced it in my own life. And so having somebody who most often works with people who are trying to process some loss or grief gives me an opportunity to talk about those things in a different way too. So there are things about what she does that are useful for me as a writer because I can then explore issues that I'm interested in. But yes, it's a strange mix of characters and a strange mix of genres, I'm aware of that.
And I guess just for listeners, we don't have the mystery and the thriller aspects of this novel solved by the supernatural. We have, and I think that that's important to communicate, because I think that that would matter to some readers. You understand? Did that matter to you when you were writing it? Yeah.
Yes, it's more like treasure hunt clues, and then the brain going to work on what could that mean. And I think we all have that in us to some extent. You know, if you're focused on something, suddenly you're bombarded with little clues from all over the place about that. Particularly happens in writing. So it's about whether you trust your intuition or not and whether you're prepared to follow it or not, I guess.
Mm. Thank you. So I mentioned the accessibility of the novel, its plot momentum and tension, and also there's something about the kind of emotional openness of the central characters make it really easy to get alongside them on their journey, understand events through them, really feel it. And that felt a lot like the best kind of young adult fiction to me.
Hmm.
Yeah. So do you want to just talk about the need to distinguish this as being for an adult audience? Obviously Bella's older, but you know,
it's funny because I've always just written the books that I want to write, and they've been labeled YA, but I don't really write down to that age group. It's more that I've chosen to write from the point of view of somebody in that age group because it's such an interesting time where you're teasing through what your values really are, and you're questioning the things that you took for granted in your childhood. So it's a really interesting time to write about. But whether it's YA or not matters less to me. All my books have, you know, swearing and bad language in them, all of them. They're all very similar. With this one, I guess I wanted to focus more on those older characters, and it's more about who's going to pick up the book and read it. But I think, you know, a young adult could equally enjoy it.
I certainly thought so. And I mean, Bella at 30, in some ways that there's something about her still dealing with aspects of self-discovery that might be reassuring for the young adult reader to know nothing actually gets settled that quickly. You know, we're all in development. So I loved the book, but I really couldn't pin it because it, as I say, it felt like the YA or adult categories were a bit arbitrary when considering this.
Yes, I think all my books are a bit like that, to be honest.
Yeah, and all the best YA fiction, as I said, you know, really is stuff that you still read and are thrilled by as an adult. So one thing I absolutely loved about the book are the way that you balance consequences and redemption in the story. And ultimately there's a goodness in the force that animates the story, but there's nothing saccharine about kind of how things play out. Is that, I wondered whether that was a cultural characteristic of yours. I mean, it's obviously quite a deliberate decision, but I wondered whether it mapped to Freya's kind of Danishness. I don't know, just it felt like, yeah, we're not going to treat this sweetly. Yeah.
No. In terms of their relationship, I really wanted to have characters who were kind to each other and kind to other people. And I think I'm so sick of the drama of a lot of story, whether it's TV or books, is about people being horrible to each other these days and that kind of slickness of meanness. And I wanted to have characters who actually treasured each other and modelled warm, kind relationships. Yeah, so that was a absolutely top of my head goal, and that as they meet more people, they draw those people into that community as well, so that over time, depending on how many books, you collect more and more people into this community of wanting to do good and wanting to be kind, just as a way of showing that this is another possible way of behaving with each other in a community. And but no, these are scary incidences that they're facing, and so they have to be dealt with in a serious manner at the same time.
Yeah, and then with real consequences for people, so nobody gets off the hook. But the goodness and the possibility of redemption still carries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which
particularly with warm support around you.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Oh no. Look, the book is called, listeners, Revenge and Rabbit Holes, the second in the Chasing Ghosts series by Mandy Hager. It's published by Cuba Press. If you're looking for a compulsive thriller mystery set in a political and cultural landscape that feels close to home, pick it up at a bookstore near you. And we can't wait for another instalment.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Vanessa Young is a biochemist, and The Reluctant Homeopath is the creative memoir that traces her journey trying to reconcile her growing experience of the efficacy of homeopathy with her deeply held scientific worldview. It's more than a memoir, with equal parts a collection of case studies from her homeopathic practice, and within them, the gems of Vanessa's psychotherapeutic insights as shared with her clients. This psychotherapeutic skill set, readers will discover, is key to her homeopathic practice. and more on that later in our interview. But tēnā koe, Vanessa, welcome to Bookends. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So, diving into it, from your rigorously scientific worldview and background, you were drawn towards homeopathy. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. Very much a scientist, still loves science, still very much brought up within that science framework of thinking, and I still apply a science lens to everything in my world. And I don't know how it ended up being homeopathy. It almost could have been anything that didn't seem to fit within the framework of science, but it was homeopathy for me. Mm. And I encountered it, and it didn't seem to make sense. And so the science part of me was really curious. So I thought really long and hard about what to do with that experience. Like, do I just shut it down and say that doesn't fit with my training, that doesn't fit with my experience, or do I follow it a little bit further and see what happens?
Right, okay. So curiosity being the thread that just you couldn't not tug. Yeah, that makes sense to me. But I imagine, regardless, that it's deeply uncomfortable trying to live with two almost opposing worldviews. And that, I guess, you don't describe a reconciliation where you bend one way or the other. In fact, you kind of no longer understand them as opposing worldviews. Can you tell us what that means for you?
Yeah, that's something that came about as a surprise in a way when I was writing, because I didn't set out to write a book. I was struggling probably for decades with this sort of internal set of critics from my science training and this new homeopathy experience who were not sitting comfortably within me. And I've been really fortunate to do a couple of those international modern letters courses at Victoria University. And in the first one, I remember sitting down on the first day, I was really nervous. There's 12 of us, and we're really carefully selected. Like, it's a huge privilege to be there. And there were 12 of us sitting in a circle and introducing ourselves. And I remember thinking, am I going to fess up? Am I, because there are scientists in the room, you know, Rebecca Priestley's running it. Am I going to tell them? And I thought, I don't want to go into something as important to me as this course in any way that wasn't genuine. You know, I wanted to be really clear and coherent. So I told them, and as I told them, I could feel the atmosphere in the room changing. Mm. And I just said casually, I just said, look, if you find this challenging, imagine what it's like living inside my mind. And Rebecca Priestley said, I'd love you to write about that, Vanessa. And I did. I started writing back in that course, that Peter Dialogue, the creative nonfiction dinner party, where I'm having a chat with this person who's mostly a representation of my inner critics, but some external critics, and we're chatting. And I started writing it then. And then I didn't do anything with it for years because I thought, well, I've done my thinking now. I've sort of had that little chat with myself. And then a few years ago, I did Harry Rickett's creative nonfiction course. And in that, I found myself writing about how I'd kind of come through something and where I was now and how I'd dealt with the issues I'd been struggling with about, you know, the science me and the homeopathic experiences. And I thought, oh, maybe this could potentially weave together. And I realised as I was writing it, which is the interesting bit about writing, because it wasn't something that I'd done before or actually had intended to do, but I realised that these parts of me weren't actually separate, that I'd actually brought my science lens to this whole conundrum, that I had looked at homeopathy experiences and I thought, that's weird, I wonder if I can repeat it. That's crazy, that's curious, I wonder if I can repeat it. And I realized that I'd done this kind of observation, repeat, which is a really valid and well-tested scientific method. And that might not be enough for many people, but it was enough for me. Mm. And it was for my science part of me to go, that's okay, yeah, you did sort of take a scientific approach. And that gave me heart, because one of the things that kept me writing was thinking how much my previous science self and many scientists today dismiss homeopathy in really unscientific ways.
Yeah. So there's some discussion of that in the book about, you know, the just the dismissing the idea of similars, which we'll get on to, and various other things like that. I just want to pull back into the something though. So for listeners with no idea, there's a short guide at the back of the book to the principles of homeopathy. And yes. I think we'll probably have listeners who have no idea. So can you run through just exactly why homeopathy is difficult for people who come from a scientific method and a scientific worldview?
Yep, totally. And I should say that my former self was deeply sceptical of things like homeopathy, and I used to give people really hard times. I remember there was a mother, and I am circling back to your question, in the school playground who was training to be a homeopath, and I really remember thinking, my child is never going to your house for play date. You know, that's
how hungry. Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, so it really did catch me unawares. So homeopathy, we use the idea of similars, which is a very old, ancient idea, instead of opposites. And I should say that I very much see Western medicine, for want of a better word, and alternative complementary medicines like sort of train tracks, and I think that we need them both. You know, we need hospitals and we need medicines. They're just different, okay? So Western medicine... this is very simplistic, might use the idea of opposites. So for inflammation, we have an anti-inflammatory. For pain, we have pain relief, and so on. In homeopathy, we match your symptoms with something that's very similar, not the same, but similar. So if you came to see a homeopath and you had stinging eyes and a runny nose, say you sort of had that every spring, we might give you a remedy made from onion, because, you know, when you chop an onion, you get that sensations. Or if you can't sleep because your thoughts are racing, we might give you a remedy made from coffee. So that's that idea of matching similar. And the second part, which is kind of even weirder really for most people with a science background, is that we use what we refer to as ultra high dilutions. And so we take, I don't, but homeopathic pharmacists take a substance and they dilute it over and over again until it gets so dilute that the chemists would say there's nothing left, and we keep going beyond that. And I might give some people a remedy that's more dilute than one drop in all the oceans of all the world. So, and there's this idea that with increasing dilution, that the potency or the efficacy of the remedies are different a lot, and you'd use different potencies for different things. So these are two bits that are quite foreign for they were for me.
Yeah, sure. So, and the guts of that second one perhaps being the most difficult thing from a scientific perspective, because really there's something almost about the kind of the essence or the essential power of the material, which is released, even though there's none of this material still present, according other than its essence. So what is it that allows you to sit with not knowing or understanding that? You know, because there's nothing that actually scientifically explains that, how something can be more potent even when it's not there, you know. So So what is it that allows you to sit with not knowing or understanding that?
Mm. And I'll just quickly say that I don't go into the science of it because that's not my area of expertise. But there are physicists who talk about there being something about the ultra-high dilutions. And there is a homeopathy research institute in the UK which has a bunch of research, heaps and heaps of experts on research. So I don't go into that side of it because it's not my area of expertise. So I what lets me go into that space is it's a sense of allowing, I suppose. It's been a meditation journey as much as anything. It's like, I think what I found was that I was very fortunate as a curious person, perhaps because of my upbringing. I don't put down barriers of things that can't be. So I allow all things to be until proven otherwise, and especially if they're repeatable, you know, experiences with someone going to a homeopath and then telling me something else, or I give someone a remedy and they come back and tell me something. So it's an allowing to be and just allowing the experience of that moment and of that person in their case just to unravel or evolve as it needs to.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So... just describing that idea of the similar, can you just, that's their foundation as well. So so can you talk more about that?
About the matching of similars too. Yeah. So So the other thing there's a third part, which is true of most complementary or Indigenous medicines, is the holistic aspect, you know, that we look at the mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, everything's in the room with us.
Yeah.
And, you know, all four walls of the whare. And so we are kind of going big picture. So if somebody comes to me with a sore thumb, I'll be talking to them. We talk for at least an hour about everything in their life, okay? And the remedy that I'll give them will match the best I can match everything. So it might, you know, there might be 500 remedies for a sore thumb, but I'll give them the one that matches something else about them as well. So it's not only the similars, which is that sort of slightly, it's hard to explain without the simplistic idea of, you know, coffee for not being able to sleep, or an onion for a runny nose. It's there's huge specificity about choosing a remedy.
And that's a lovely reference to Te Whare Tapuwha, which is part of my question, that approach, that holism of the approach, that must make this application quite attractive to people from a broad variety of cultures, where that holism is maybe more central and more important to them. Do you find that in your practice?
I always trust that the people I can help will come through the door. I don't whakapapa Māori, I whakapapa Celtic. So right. I have a lineage of herbalists in my lineage going back. And so homeopathy feels really comfortable. For me, the whole idea of treating people in this way, or with, you know, outside of traditional medicine and with something as big as potentially the holistic aspects, which, as you say, are comfortable in lots of cultures. One thing that's interesting is that a lot of places overseas do use homeopathy a lot more than New Zealand does. So I have quite a few people who come from Europe, people who are travelling here, and a huge number of oncologists in France will refer to people to a homeopath. So there's a lot more complementarity and interconnectedness, and therefore acceptance of other ways of being that are foreign to us here in New Zealand, except for the mātauranga. And yeah, the understanding of rongoā. So I think there is, there's a continuity or congruency there within New Zealand, and an understanding of there being things that can look at us holistically and look at all of us and take all of ourselves into account.
That's so interesting. And I, if I tried to reduce my understanding of the benefits of homeopathy for your clients to an explanation that was based on the deep psychosomatic connections between mind and body, right? And the fact that, especially for lots of chronic illnesses, and the fact that you explore those connections really deeply in your conversations as a practitioner. If I reduced it down to just that there might be really good therapeutic benefits just from those conversations and about thinking about your illness differently, what would you say to me?
I would say that we can't separate out the consultation from the remedy. You know, people come and they connect, we connect, and in connecting with people, we change. And, you know, I'm not a physicist, and yet we understand now there's an observer effect for physics experiments. So who's there, who's in the room, who's watching effects, what happens to the wave and particle, that's probably the extent of my knowledge. And so, yes, that was one of the things that did my head in. You know, my science brain would go, hey, hang on a minute, there's nothing in the remedies, it's just having a good old chat. And then the placebo effect would come up as well, you know. And so, again, experience was my friend. So I would think, okay, so that's a really good point. If it is just the chat, then how come I can help a baby? How come I can have someone go away and come back and say, tell me something positive about something that I've, you know, done in the consult, when it involves a baby or a very young child? And then, you know, if you think about the placebo effect as well, which is huge and fantastic, I'm very much in awe of the placebo effect. How come something that homeopaths give people come back and tell us it's helped them, when the pharmacy or the GP have also before that given them something, because many people have reached the end of the medical system when they come to us. So if it was placebo, if it was solely placebo, these are the sorts of things that would help me sort of just let my science parts of me just skate. Just hang on. It's okay. I've got you. I'm not being unscientific here. I'm looking closely and this is what I see.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. And so thank you for that. I guess just that goes to that idea of the psychotherapeutic kind of conversation and the discovery of the person and what's going on for them. You're often kind of reflecting that in your choice of similar rather than just the physical symptoms as they presented. And you mentioned that, but where did you get your psychotherapeutic training?
I mean, you put a book out like this, you're always a bit sort of worried that people aren't going to like it, right? You know, I'm circling around to your question. So I thought maybe psychotherapists would hate this book or maybe scientists are going to hate it. That was a surprise to hear so many positive things from medical and scientific people and from counsellors that I know. We're not trained to be psychotherapists, although we are trained during the diploma to be with people and to listen. We do hours and hours of case studies and we do hours of supervised cases and so on. But I think everybody's different. And what I've ended up falling back on is my meditation training. So when I'm sitting there, I'm just really allowing a space for a person to be and then, you know, seeing where it takes us. And those pictures I draw, which I was really embarrassed that the publisher wouldn't let me have an illustrator. So they're all my own little scribbles. But when I'm in the clinic, they only come when I'm in the clinic, I'll suddenly find myself drawing a picture and turning it around to someone and going, this is what you're doing, this is them, this is you, this is blah, blah, blah. And then it would somehow help the conversation. So, and I learned really quickly that I had to write down what I'd just said because I'd forget. So later I could go back to those diagrams and go, oh, maybe I'll redraw it or I'll reuse it for another person or something like that.
Mm. Science communications is one of your other kind of strings to your bow, though, isn't it? You do science communications and I imagine those kind of graphical illustrations is part of that.
Oh, I love pictures and I love diagrams, yeah.
Totally. Look, we've got to wrap up because we could go on for hours. Obviously, this is fascinating. I'm interested to know if you think that the Venn diagram of people who love reading books and of people who are open to homeopathic methods, so if we did the Venn diagram of those populations, would it have a greater or smaller overlap than a Venn diagram of the general population? Do you think our listeners are going to find this be more open to homeopathy than general folks? Just what do you reckon?
I think we tend as people to listen to stuff we don't get triggered by. You know, we tend to read and listen to things that we're already a bit aligned to. I would hope that people will look at the book not just about homeopathy. It's kind of not about homeopathy. It's just a kind of case study for what do you do when you encounter something that's outside your worldview or science worldview. And I think it's a conversation that needs to be had. It's almost like this conversation needs to come out of the closet because I've felt shamed by my own internal science critics for decades for having thoughts and experiences that didn't fit into what I'd been taught at university. So I'm just glad this conversation's happening and that I can speak in a way that I don't feel censored or silenced by those parts of me anymore.
Beautiful, Vanessa. Thank you so much and for your bravery and sharing your story and for coming on to have the chat. The book is The Reluctant Homeopath by Vanessa Young. It's published by Cuba Press and available from bookstores nationwide.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Recently, I talked with debut novelist Lana Hart at a lively and well-attended event at Tūranga, the public library in Otatahi. Lana is an accomplished broadcaster, award-winning podcaster and journalist. Nice People on Plains is her first foray into fiction writing, and I began by asking her what skills and experience from her successful career she had brought into writing this book.
Wow, lots of experience. One of them strikes out, particularly for this book, is that one of my jobs in 2017 was to support Filipinos coming to Canterbury for the Canterbury rebuild and to get them ready to come to Aotearoa and learning things like, you know, settlement and Kiwi slang and tax systems and healthcare systems. And so I needed to travel to the Philippines every 6 weeks, and my team was based in Auckland, so there was just a lot of travel. I went up there every week. I was raising a family, and there was a lot of disconnection between my family and these and my community. Even things like my body or my interests seemed to get left behind because I was very focused on this work, but also traveling a heck of a lot. And it's a 12 to 14 hour daytime flight to the Philippines. So I had an awful lot of time to look out the window at clouds. And that experience definitely made me think about this story. It inspired this story, thinking about a character who, you know, did feel a sense of, you know, hardworking character that just had a sense of not feeling quite herself because of the rigidity of air travel, of hotel rooms, of coming home from a big day's work, rewarding day's work, but you're alone in a nice hotel room. It's clinical. Everything is square and polished, and it just didn't feel real and authentic to me. So that kind of inspired the Cora in Nice People on Planes, who has a strong disconnect between the life she wants and her career, which is starting to take off, and having to be in other cities all the time, never almost working in her own city of Chicago. So that experience definitely got me going. And I guess as you've alluded to, the experience of being a migrant in New Zealand definitely informed this story. So working with the refugee and migrant community here in Canterbury, but also being a migrant myself, you know, you have this sense of belonging to two or more places at once. It's not a strong sense of connection to a particular place. And that, again, is something that I think migrants are very familiar with, of feeling a little bit of a background uncertainty about all of the places that you are. There's not a solid, strong sense of belonging in a single place, if that makes sense. And again, Cora experiences that in this story. She has incredibly strong connections to New Zealand, but she also has strong sense of place in Chicago.
But I'm also interested in what you had to tamper down or put aside in order to become a fiction writer. What were some of the things that you would find, you know, easy as a journalist and a broadcaster that might have been getting in the way of your writing fiction?
Yeah, good question. You know, look, moving from nonfiction to fiction is a whole bunch of things. You know, it's a lot of fun because you're not stuck to the single truth. And covering stories for other people, particularly migrants and their stories, it means that, you know, there is an expertise in their experience, or perhaps interviewing an expert or talking to someone about the news. Those are real facts that you need to stick to. Even writing my travel memoir, things happened. And so the truth is it's malleable a little bit. You can shape it into a story, but you can't move too far away from that. So moving into fiction, and I started with short stories, was a lot of fun. It's a lot of unfun editing all that, but the writing, the first drafts and, you know, imagining what you can do with your characters is very, very different from journalism. And I really enjoyed that. I mean, in some ways, fiction is imagining untruths, and journalism is really reimagining the truth, if you will, if you know what I mean. So imagining things that didn't happen is awfully liberating after you've done, you know, stick to the facts sort of approach to writing. One of the things that I think it was negative about moving from journalism to fiction was the lack of people. So there's that wonderful, I've wrote down this wonderful quote about the loneliness of the job. I know there's some writers in the room who would relate to Ernest Hemingway's quote, writing at its best is a lonely life. And it's true. I mean, you spend hours and hours, you know, alone in a room and nobody sees your stuff until you're ready. And for me, that took years. For many writers, it's months. Journalism is the opposite. You're in the face of people. You're doing what we're doing now, more in our interview might ramble for, you know, with a huge range of topics, and there's lots of interaction and engagement. With journalism, you can't make a story alone. You lean on other people. That's what I really miss. You know, I miss the people, the interactions, the exposure to different walks of life and ideas that you're stuck in the middle of with journalism. And for opinion writing as well, I had to talk to people about what they thought rather than just, you know, my own opinion. So that's a big shift for me, is to kind of be alone. And I'll figure out how to be an extrovert in the world of fiction writing. But at the moment, I do find it quite challenging to be stuck in my office a lot. So I do miss that. And hopefully I can get a nice balance of the kinds of writing that I do in the future.
Let's talk then about the book, because we need to start, I guess, with Cora, who is the narrator of this book. She's the person the book to begin with, is the person that whose life we are most absorbed by. Of course, there are similarities to your experiences and your background, but as we all know, it's not you. Where, you know, which bits of you were useful to inform the character of Cora, and which of the bits you had to completely start from scratch with?
Yeah. So Cora is, I would say, a modern 21st century woman. She's hardworking. She's intelligent. She cares a lot about the people around her. She's leaned on by a lot of people around her. So a lot of people rely on her to be strong. And she also worries a lot, and she, you know, catastrophizes and is anxious about some things. So I think in many ways she's an everyday woman, like a lot of probably the women in the room, who, you know, we have a lot of layers to us, so we're not a single thing. And so Cora is all of those things. And I don't know how much of that is autobiographical for me, but I do know a lot of women like that in my life. But what is different is her anxiety. She does a lot of things that mean that she's not coping very well with the busy world around her. And because she's a solo mom, had three marriages, has a sense of rejection and is, you know, kind of searching for something, she has a bit of a space in her life that she's trying to fill and look for something. And I don't know, as she doesn't know, you know, how quite to do that or who to do it with. So she's got a yearning and a longing that is part of the story, because when she comes to New Zealand, she has a strong sense of place, belonging, and a satisfaction here. And so that anxiety is laid to rest a little bit.
Now, this is a book where you have to pay real attention to the timeline in the beginning until you kind of work out why Lana's done it the way she's done it, because these nice people that she meets on planes are interspersed with, shall we say, the incidents of her meeting these nice people on planes and, you know, starting to reminisce about the kind of things they have in common with her life. And then the book will jump to her being back in her beloved part of the Coromandel, that is something that's been in her mother's family for years. And it can take a little while before you start working out why she's done. These meetings with these people on planes starts starts to make Cora question what's going on. She can't work out if there is anything that's happening, any coincidences. Is it chance? Is it not? But somehow, some of the things that are alluded to, some of the things that are spoken about, they come back, don't they, when she gets to New Zealand? But how much fun was that, trying to, you know, work with those threads and weave them into the story at the right time and, you know, with the right amount of information?
Yeah, good question. It was really fun at first because there were lots of threads that I needed to pull through and it was clean. So the first drafts were a lot of conversations with people on planes and then she goes to New Zealand. So the chronology was very simple. Send it to a developmental editor, Michelle Elvey from Dunedin, who's done a lot of work with authors here. And she made me think differently about the pacing. I had a serious problem, and that's that the first half of the book gave readers jet lag because it was plane ride after plane ride after plane ride. And I could see what the problem was. So I needed to mix it up a bit. And I went to my friend Sally's, who's in the second row here. I went to her house for a writing retreat. She was away 1 week, and I used her house, and I used her lounge floor to put the chapters in a different order. And that worked. So that's what you see is some conversations in the New Zealand and conversations in New Zealand. And that gave me a big fat headache for about a year because all of those chronological facts had to come through in a different order, in a different way. So it was fun at first, Maureen.
Yeah.
After that, it was a complete dog's breakfast trying to line up when that thing happened in the first draft versus the 13th draft. So it was really tough. And, you know, in that weird kind of writer's kind of way, a little bit of fun. Because when you got it right and you read it again for the trillionth time and it worked, it was very rewarding to see that the thing you had in chapter 3 that's now in chapter 14 belongs there.
Her connection with New Zealand is very strong. And obviously the parts of the book where you're writing about Maroa Bay up in the Coromandel will resonate so much with us. But then you realise that you're writing for a wider, much wider audience. And I think we talked the other day about how you had to use your cultural knowledge of both places to inform the writing of the book as well.
And there's a lot of things which was really interesting as a American New Zealander to explore about those cultural differences and the openness of Americans, which is kind of, you know, well known, to speak to strangers, to talk about candid things openly, much more openly than in a British country like New Zealand. And so that was fun to remember and play around with. And, you know, a lot of the scenes in New Zealand don't have that candidness, you know, that frankness that you see with people that she meets along the way. So that was fun in many ways to explore those differences because some of the New Zealand beta readers, the first readers to give feedback for me, were surprised at the conversations that Cora had on planes in America. But I wasn't at all, as an American, you know, surprised by that. I know there's some Americans in the room, and it's amazing some of the conversations you have with strangers, and especially in intimate quarters, you know, in a plane. And of course, we find out, you know, through the story, what they were doing there, what their role was in Cora's overall story.
Cora does the natural world, and especially, obviously, at her beloved bay and in the Coromandel, gives her a huge amount of peace and brings her all the memories crowd in of her life there as a young girl, her life there as a young wife and mother. All those things are really important to her and give her strength. The other thing that gives her strength, I think, in the book is her interest, probably not the right word, but the clouds that she observes. But throughout the book, she is constantly aware of and looking at the clouds. And the clouds, in fact, take a role, a more active role in the book, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Where did that come from?
I'm not sure if I want to spoil that, but they are actively in her life. And they are a presence. And I guess, you know, if you're a sailor, the waves are important to you in the sky. And, you know, your environment becomes very important. And this woman spends a lot of time in planes. So therefore, clouds really are an important part of her natural environment when you're flying, you know, 2-4 times every week and sometimes more. So because her life is like that, she spends a lot of time looking at them. And I wanted to also, I live with my partner is a weather outdoors avalanche person, and we often talk about clouds and the importance of weather and what that signals. And I wanted to incorporate that because in Cora's world, she's looking out the window seat all the time, wondering about her life, imagining things. And then she knows a lot, you know, about the science of clouds. So it does become a character in her life and give her, responds to her and gives her emotions that she kind of, you know, wants to talk about and be a part of. So, yes, it is. Is it a presence in her life? And I tried to make that really clear. I tried not to overdo the science of it and really try to focus on the feelings that she got. And it also connects Cora to an important family member because, you know, her grandma, who had a lot to do with her upbringing, was very into the natural world of Aotearoa. And that really affects Cora and who she's become as a woman. So, yeah, it was always there. And I love how... in some ways it mirrors Cora's emotions and becomes a bellwether for what's going on in her life. Not always, but often. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice People on Planes by Lana Hart is published by Katima Publishing.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Planes Media.